You're listening to the good.
Don't call me Paino.
The bad.
Absolute.
And the rugby.
Folded like a deck chair.
With Paino, Lord, and the Husk. I don't know what that means.
Hello, everybody, and a very warm welcome once again to another episode of The Good, The Bad and The Rugby in partnership with City Index, the leading provider of spread betting, CFD and FX trading. Last week, we took the game to task a little bit. We asked what rugby was trying to be and how it should go about getting there. I'm not sure we found many answers. We certainly found one or two wrinkles in the book cover. Did you listen?
I did. Oops. I actually listened to it at twice speed.
Oh, did you?
Genuinely, that's how I listen to podcasts. Yeah, because you can still hear it. It's bizarre. If you're really good at listen to something to learn, then that's how you do it. And I just sat in the car and listened to an hour and a half in double the time.
Half the time. It's fair to say, and I don't think we were expecting necessarily, but we had an enormous amount of interaction from you guys and girls on socials, on YouTube, via email. We had a lot of feedback and opinion from all corners of the game as well. We had emails and calls from Premiership Rugby, the RPA, RFU. We had contact from the clubs, a number of players. And this week we thought we'd dig a little bit deeper. I'm not sure that's a good idea, but we thought we might as well keep going. Fair to say last week we got the view of those inside the day-to-day. We had a current player in Ellis, we had a bold new agent from Roc Nation and the owners of the Dragons and Newcastle. They are living and breathing the day-to-day. We touched on star power, we touched on the money in the game and the entertainment value of rugby right now. This week we're joined by two men who know more than most about what goes on inside rugby's city walls, but their perspective is even more informative and interesting now that they find themselves more on the outside, a place that Husk is only too familiar with. Mark Evans played hooker for Saris. He's the former CEO of Harlequins, Melbourne Storm in the NRL and Global Rapid Rugby. In 10 years at Quins, he developed the Stoop into a 15,000-seater stadium. He grew attendances by 9,000. He developed the Big Game concept, which has just had its 13th year, and he developed a best-in-class academy. He was also in charge of the club when it was engulfed by Bloodgate. He's co-authored a book called Unholy Union, which is a great read if you're interested in business and some of the challenges of professional rugby. Great to have you with us, Mark. Brett Gosper played for Racing Club for 9 years and was part of the team that famously wore pink bow ties and drank champagne at halftime in the finals of the 1987 and 1990 French Championships. He took this flair into a successful career in advertising before becoming the CEO of World Rugby in 2012, a position he held for 9 years. And in that time, he oversaw rugby's return to the Olympics, a hugely commercially successful Rugby World Cup 2015, and the first World Cup in Asia 4 years later. He left 12 months ago to head up the NFL operations in the UK and Europe. A very warm welcome to both of you. Today, we're going to get a bit more into the club versus country landscape and the various threads in between. Feels a little bit like we're in the boardroom today. Good of you to dress up.
Casual, informal, bit like Steve Jobs.
Love it. Brett, first of all, thank you for coming on our show. 1 year almost exactly since you left and moved to the NFL. Is the air sweeter? Have the shoulders dropped? Or are you missing rugby a little bit?
I think you miss parts of it because, you know, some great people in and around the sport, and there's always something spectacular happening and interesting and so on. But yeah, there's a little bit of lightness as well because you do get weighed down by the politics after a while. And not that it's politics that's nasty, it's just it's predictable national interest politics. And you try very hard to drive things through, and you succeed sometimes and you don't other times. But yeah, you've got to bring a lot of people with you and get a lot of people to agree before something substantial happens. And that can wear you after a while. But I don't think I'm back in another sport now. It's got its own challenges. So I've just moved on, let's say.
You operate at a level of sport where politics is everything almost. Are you able, do you feel able now to talk freely about your time in rugby, or are you still having to play the game a little bit because of who you are, what you do, and where you might end up?
It's a good question, and I was thinking that before I came here. You probably by habit still play the game a little bit, and also I still represent another sport, so I can't be completely reckless and write a kiss all book or whatever. But I can be reasonably relaxed about commenting on rugby, I think, and what my impressions were of that period. Yeah,
give us a percentage. What percentage of what you'd like to say do you feel comfortable saying?
I think, look, majority. I'd say 75 to 80%. The 20% uncomfortable is, yeah, you know, I feel I've been in a privileged, rarefied atmosphere, and I should respect that, and I certainly should respect relationships that I've had with people and some of the confidentialities that I've shared over time. So you've got to be a little bit careful.
So you just change the names. We won't name them, but we'll just change. You know,
everyone's safe though, because I've got such a bad. Yeah. I've got such a bad memory. I couldn't write a book. I'd be scrambling to do that, I think. But
you'll forgive me for asking. It's just interesting to know. I don't want to take this anywhere that you don't want to. And you're a consummate pro anyway, so you'll be very very adept at flicking away anything you don't want to. Mark, you never stop. I don't think you've stopped in 26 years, have you? Beetling around the game. What's on your to do list at the moment?
What am I doing? Well, I finished up at Perth just under a year ago, yep, not through choice, through COVID. Couldn't get back into the country. The Australians wouldn't let me in,
right,
you see.
Unlike others who they were. Yes,
well, yes, well, quite. Three times I tried, and right. I was working.
You didn't have
for
a medical exemption then?
No, I'm afraid not. I was working for Australia's richest man, and he wrote me a very nice letter. I thought, that'll sort it out, won't it? No, didn't move in an inch. So which I found quite encouraging in some ways from a political point of view.
Yeah.
But ran it from here from a year, but it became untenable. So since then I do what I do between exec roles. I revamp my old consultancy firm and try and add a bit of value somewhere in various sports and a few little projects in rugby and arena project and one or two other things. So yeah, try and keep busy.
Good. It's very good to have you both on. I want to start with, I suppose, following on from last week. We're talking about the fact that rugby as a professional sport is now 26 years old. And Seymour Kirdy, who owns Newcastle, thought that was the blink of an eye. He thought that there's a lot more to come and we don't need to rush or panic any of these things. I'm paraphrasing. You've been involved in most of the ride, Mark. Has rugby made a good fist of professionalism in your view?
That's a really wide question. And I'm tempted to say, in which countries and
in
on,
the territories
on what metrics
that you know and your experiences? It is a generalised question, but taking professional rugby as a whole,
well,
give it a mark out of 10.
Out of 10, and then I'll try and put it into context. I'd say 6, okay, maybe closer to 5. But I don't underestimate the difficulty. I won't plug the book again after it's been out a while anyway. And it wasn't run to done loads of copies. Just try to influence the agenda, if I'm honest.
Okay.
But my co-author, who is a beautiful, beautiful writer, came up with what I think is the best description I've ever heard of rugby union, its place in the sports spectrum. It's as if in 1895, rugby union was in the catapult and it was pulled back,
yeah,
and held for 100 years. Where all the other sports made their mistakes and did their thing and wrestled with all the same issues rugby is now wrestling with. Rugby union hardly moved. It grew, but it hardly moved. And then in 1995, they let go of the catapult and we missed the 20th century and went straight into the 21st. So we shouldn't be surprised that that's made things really difficult. And it has. Having said that, I don't think that excuses some of the self-inflicted wounds that the sport has inflicted on itself. And my particular interest is in the leagues and the club level within England and Europe. Mm. Okay, Brent's got far more experience than I have at international level. Obviously, I've had experience in Australia and on the New Zealand system very well, et cetera, et cetera. So I think you have to be careful generalising. But okay. I do think we could do things a heap better than we do at the moment. And so in that sense, I suppose I agree with Seymour. I think there's loads of opportunity and growth. And I'm quite impatient. I'd like to make some quite big changes because I don't think the structures and the systems we've got in place at the moment are going to see us well in the next 10 to 20 years.
Interesting. Be careful of generalizations, but I'm going to have another go anyway. Give professional international rugby a mark out of 10 for the last 26 years.
Look, I'd probably get a higher mark than that because it's probably not gone through quite the transformation that the league and clubs have gone through. It's the product at the other end. The World Cup has been here since pre-professional. Six Nations has, in many ways, for a long, Super Rugby, the Championship and so on. Well, let's keep it at the international level, the Championship in the South and so on. So these are all tournaments at the international level that carry the games, you know, spectators in a way, and the value of the sport. I mean, an international game is worth about 20 times a club game in broadcast value. So it's continued to grow and grow strongly. A World Cup was 80 million of profit pounds in New Zealand in 2011. I think I'll make 400 million in France. So if things align, yeah. Not putting pressure on anyone. But
you can say it now.
But it, you know, it could be up in that area. So it has grown remarkably even in the last 10 to 12 years or so.
Are you surprised the gap between international and club rugby, I'm going to say, is widening, but you might see it differently. It feels like it is widening. The club game, certainly in England, has got huge challenges at the moment. The international game, World Cup, Six Nations, etc., are growing year on year.
Yeah, and I think let's put one or two numbers on this. And to say that, take the Premiership. Like, I mean, you could take some of the three big European leagues. Let's take the Premiership, for example. Top 14, the numbers are bigger. The revenue in that the Premiership as a league generates has quadrupled in less than 20 years.
And where's that come from?
Well, mainly like most professional sports, largely through broadcast, but increased attendances, increased sponsorship. Sport's not a complicated business at heart. There's five revenue streams, really, maybe six. Okay, and to move the dial, you've got to work on all six. But the one that really, and the biggest dial, broadcast stroke media, broadcast's a bit old-fashioned, isn't it?
Love it.
That, in a way, comes at the end of all the other stuff, because it's all about audience size. I mean, it's about how do you grow the size of your audience? People who either turn up and watch it live or watch it on some kind of medium. That's really what professional sport is all about. The Premiership's quadrupled it in 20 years. You can forget the first couple of years where you can't even get the accounts. You go to about 2002, 2003, you add them all up because, you know, we wouldn't possibly just have something like put it all together for people to look at and make it easy. You have to go through trawling all the accounts, turning over about £50 million. And now pre-COVID, because that's distorted everything, turns over about 200. Now, that's not stellar growth, but it's not bad. The problem is
outgoings.
The collective losses in the early noughties were about 2 million, 3 million for the whole league. The whole league lost about 2 or 3 million around 2004. Right? That was its, in terms of P&L, that was its best time. Pre-COVID, it lost 50 million. So anyone who tells me this is all about driving revenues, and of course you have to drive your revenues, that's almost stating the obvious. But driving revenues on its own will not, in my opinion, I could be wrong, won't fix it. Because we've driven them for 20 years and the game is more, the league rather, is more indebted and than it ever has been. I'll just finish this point off. And the first argument come back to that is to say, but sport's not a P&L business, Mark. And I'd agree, it's not. There's lots of examples of sport where clubs and leagues have lost a lot of money operationally. But the money is made in the asset value appreciation. In other words, the clubs that you own are worth more.
Mm.
Okay? So if that were true in the English Premiership, people who own those clubs in the early 2000s would have sold them or still be holding them, and they'd be worth many, many multiples of what they bought them for. There is absolutely zero evidence of that happening in the English Rugby Premiership. And you look at all the people, some of whom Haskell know.
Mm.
You know, the guy who owned Wasps after Chris Wright and before Derek Richardson, Steve Hayes.
Steve Hayes.
Right? People, Steve Hayes, Brian Kennedy, Andrew Brownsword, guys who put a lot of money into the sport. They kept their club going and kept them alive in lots of ways for various times. Did not make a penny. They didn't. Nigel Ray will never make a penny out of Saracens, okay? And you could say, how should I assume some rich guys? Well, a lot of the other stakeholders have done really, really well. Player salaries have gone up massively over the period. Coaches' salaries have gone up massively over the period. I stand accused. Administrators' salaries have gone up massively over the period.
Well done you, yeah.
Well, not quite so much, but there we go. My point is this. That doesn't happen automatically. It happens because of the structures and the systems that we have. if we don't change the structures and the systems, it will simply keep on happening just with larger numbers, would be my view.
Okay.
I was going to say, I mean, I 100% agree. One of the things I was going to talk about is actually having seen the ownership stuff from the other perspective. You know, like we last week's show, listening to the owners, you know, talked about the fact that, yes, there is some players in the world game with some real big money, but a lot of these guys, when you look at their valuations, 30, 40 million quid, you know, obviously it's still a lot of money, but when you're losing 4 or 5 million every year, your club, and there isn't that continued value, I'm always very surprised as to why you would ever get into rugby, because a lot of these guys, like you said, the Steve Hayes's, some of these other people, they saw it as a business opportunity. They thought, oh, do you know what? We can make money, because you would never get into a business situation, buy a club, unless you've got hundreds and billions where you can write it off to make money. And I think you're exactly right. Like but I would say that I know we've tried to develop the game, but I would say I don't think a lot of the thought process is behind how we actually develop it, how we within the business sphere is actually that good. I think there's a lot of kind of amateur approaches. I think you look at the way clubs market themselves, the way the clubs engage themselves, the way that they set up their businesses. You know, they're doomed to failure before they've started. I find that, you know, we're looking at clubs, the way they were run, you know, Wasps back in the day. We used to win everything. We used to go to Twickenham, sell it out, 80,000. Just didn't translate to Adam's Park.
You were
trying
out of a porter cabin,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and we didn't have the facilities. You know, our branding, our marketing was very, very poor. And one of my concerns is that I do agree that if you know, we've grown in revenue, but actually the losses have just stayed the same. And I think it won't change until we drastically change the way the whole Premiership is done. And I feel we have to kind of disassociate ourselves from some of the old values, but we can talk about that a little bit later on.
Very different sports, but compare and contrast what you were doing with what you are doing.
Yeah, and it's very contrasted. You know, running a governing body is very different to being involved in a league, but the contrast is huge. And all of these issues that are being discussed were discussed and managed over the last 100 years in the NFL, so they've had a bit of a head start. And they always say that they're current management is we're walking on the shoulders of giants who set our stall out in a way that there's an equalisation of revenues. 75% of all revenues are shared equally by all of the teams. There's a levelling out of in the things like the draft and so on to make sure it's incredibly competitive. There's a salary cap, which is $208 million, the salary cap in the NFL.
Yeah. What we could do with that in rugby.
we could do with the salary cap that's linked to revenue.
Oh, that's
the
it,
point
isn't it?
Is that we haven't got one.
Yeah,
right.
That's the point. Sorry to interject. No. That's the point. That the level of the cap, and if the cap is only one of about 15 things, by the way, I wish we'd stop. Honestly, if you gave me the other 14, you can get rid of the cap.
Right.
The other 14 will do it on its own. Doesn't need it.
Total revenue, salary revenue is the ceiling's 47% of NFL revenue. So yeah. Go beyond your means.
And NRL, where I've worked, obviously, it's player revenues are 29% of
total
of player generated revenues. It gets a bit arcane. You get into the weeds a little bit, but the central point is we need to link payments to the level of revenue generated.
Yeah.
So that when revenues go up, player payments go up. And when they go down or they flatline, salaries to participants do exactly the same. Last week, I really agreed with it about giving the players a stronger voice, consulting them more, et cetera, et cetera. That's all great stuff. But all the successful sports around the world, the ones who've got longevity, have a link between the total amount paid to the players and the total amount of revenue generated. And you can debate whether it should be 28% or... So New Zealand Rugby's got it. This is not a thing that isn't in rugby. New Zealand rugby's number is about 35%. 35% of the revenue generated by New Zealand rugby goes to the professional players. I don't think I've got that number, but they've got a very strong players union.
I can't remember the percentage, but there is a percentage.
Right? So this is not something that doesn't exist in rugby.
So if you're whirling here to revenues...
It doesn't exist in our...
If you're whirling here to revenues, what would the salary cap be?
Let's say that 200 million that the league generates is all... player revenue. Most of it is, actually.
Yeah.
There's a bit of it that isn't. So, for example, if you had a property arm, so Wasps are a good example, you wouldn't include Wasps' hotel earnings and you wouldn't include their their casino earnings, all right? Because that's their choice to have a bigger group.
Yeah.
But it includes sponsorship and broadcast money and ticketing and whatever. So let's say it's 200. And if you say a pretty sensible number is about 30%, yeah?
Yep.
So you just do a real simple...
65 million
It's a really simple... It's 200 divided by... Well, now it's ridiculously 13. What a dumb number that That's is. Really. So what's that? And then you can then take a percentage away. It ends at about 4 million.
Okay. So not that far away, given that they're coming down.
But we've been up at 8 and 9.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
You know, because, and this is James's point, and I do take your point about the way the game is marketed at club level and at league level. But if you're constantly losing money, there's never any profit margin to invest.
Yeah.
And so what happens? You spend, and look, I've lived it at four different clubs, you know, in various countries. You spend all your time keeping the lights on and trying to keep a team competitive. You don't have much surplus to invest. And what we do, again, in this country, even worse,
yeah,
what money we do generate, we distribute it all. The centre, which should be doing all the heavy lifting in marketing and promotion and digital engagement and all the rest of it, hasn't got any money to do it. Because it's all been distributed to the clubs because they're losing so much money, they're trying to mitigate the losses. The whole thing doesn't add up.
Okay. I want to come back to this, but I want to get almost up to the top of the tree. You did an interview, Brett, with The Telegraph a while ago. Former World Rugby CEO says, role in American football has opened his eyes to what can be achieved when everyone pulls together. Rugby suffers a little bit from fragmented interests, you say, which can stop it moving forwards at times. I think there are lessons for rugby and other sports about how the NFL is aligned for the benefit of all. It's an all-for-one and one-for-all organisation. You go on to sort of talk about, in a bit more detail, the fragmentations. Can you just sort of paraphrase some of the most frustrating elements that you came up against? And we are an hour and a half show, so I don't know how long you want to take. But some of the most frustrating elements that you came up against personally in your role with World Rugby.
I think it was just difficult getting the alignment of the different interests, just from a calendar point of view, from a sharing of the players point of view, getting countries north and south aligned on the right program, money, calendar. It was always money and calendar.
Yeah.
And then there was always the static of the clubs, which was more than static because they pay the players the vast majority, if not all, of their salary. And then you've got the rift between the leagues across the channel and on the other side of, you know, the Celtic League, United, as they call it now, et cetera. So there were, and then within even the international sphere, you had a group like the Six Nations, which certainly wanted to maintain their independence and do things their way and didn't particularly like World Rugby pushing into their area.
So both of you obviously talking about kind of that there are problems that are quite clear that could be fixed. You said 13 or 14 things. Talking about CVC investing, we were talking before the show, and this is my opinion. It seems like rugby, people have a business mindset and understand what the game could be. And I feel that, you know, we talked about NFL model, about going long-winded, about creating an entertainment business which is sustainable, which is, you know, and then you obviously have a lot of people involved in rugby were part of the legacy. They either played rugby at school, they're part of the grassroots setup, they have an idealised view of it, you know, it's what we all grew up and all the values. But within that becomes kind of this sort of almost older view about that, you know, and it sort of holds us back a little bit. And some of the comments you see on the show is, well, money will kill us and the money will do this. And people talk about the grassroots element. I don't know if you guys agree with this, but I feel that there's this, we have to be decided quite clearly, whether it's the club game or the international game, what is it we're about, and sort of understand that I think there are two separate things. There is the club game, international game, and there's the amateur game. And we have to lose the threads that hold us back to those old belief systems and remember that actually, sadly, everything we talked about comes back to finances within a reason, within a certain point. Actually, that's what makes the money go around. If we've got an international game that makes money and is entertaining, if we have a club game that can make money, is sustainable and entertaining and gets an increase in people through the gate, that's what matters. But for me, everything is always brought back to this, you know, it'll kill rugby, it'll take away the values, they'll ruin it. I just don't see that the two can cohabit. It's either got to be business or it's got to be something else, because all these old ideals and these old people who believe it are the ones that cause the trouble, because they just don't see or can't separate it. I don't know if you have any views on that.
I don't agree with that.
Fine, do you not?
No. Okay. No, I don't.
You see rugby as one product as opposed to a professional game which you go for it and an amateur game which you protect.
This is a little bit when this is going back 20 years. When I went to Harlequins and I hated them with a passion. Couldn't stand them. Right? I'm from South Wales, and they represented everything I hated about English rugby. You know, upper middle class, posh boys from public schools. Couldn't bear them.
Hi, everyone.
Couldn't bear them. Is that right? I didn't know.
Yeah. We hide it well.
Yeah. And they said, oh, you won't fit in their mark, you know, and when I got there, I couldn't find all these people they were talking about. They were great. Mm. They were really wanting to move forward. They didn't want to stay as they were. They knew they had to change, and it was great. And people always talk about, I think it's a little bit of a straw man. I'm not sure. I mean, if rugby's lacked for a lot of things in this country and others over the last 20 years, but people with business acumen in the sport, it hasn't really been short of them. And yet
they're not getting it right.
And they don't make the right decisions.
And therefore, I think it's more cultural rather than some kind of actually trying to hold the game back.
But what I mean about that, the cultural thing I think is interesting, because what I mean is it's that culture that what they believe rugby is and what they want it to be is just not sustainable. Because, you know, we've got comments on this, I know Alex will come on to it later. You just talk about, we had this very slick guy from Rock Nation on, very American.
Michael Yormack.
You know, like an absolute boy talking. And for a lot of people, your barber-wearing demographic that you were saying, I don't think is rugby. I think it's much more open-ended than it is, and it's much less elitist than it appears. But a lot of that mentality has not caught up with the fact that we are in a game that's about business, which is about sustainability, about entertainment. I just think culturally, if we don't change that mindset. Yeah.
Although I get the feeling, I mean, I'm not sure that's what's holding the sport back, if something's holding it back, because if you sit in Rugby World Cup meetings, sit in council meetings where you're announcing the broadcast deals you've done, the sponsorship deals you've done, how many tickets you've sold, how much that's grown, everyone in the room wants more money in the sport, because they know more money in the sport means more money to the different federations, unions around the world. It means you can invest in America if you have to in some way, invest in other parts of the world. So, you know, you were saying before that the clubs have trouble. There's no central pot to invest. Everyone's just surviving off their own. In world rugby, there's a huge element of investment in the sport because the money goes back to the unions who invest in their own territories. But also we invest in a future bigger, bolder, more remunerative World Cup. So I don't get a sense of people sit in the room, certainly at the national level in a council, going, oh, there's too much money in the game, we're going too professional. No one ever, it's the opposite.
No, I didn't mean that it's going, there's too much money in the game. What I meant is that that a lot of people feel that if we were to do what is required, right, which is to
you'll
be
selling the value, you'll the abandon
that's,
the values
that's
of the sport.
Point. Yeah.
Well, there again, I guess it depends on what you're selling and how you're selling
it. Because a lot of people, like, for rugby to be sustainable, I think we obviously need to engage the youth. I think the game is too complicated. I think for the layman, everybody I know who isn't in rugby circles talks about rugby and they go, oh, I watch a bit of rugby. Do you know the ones who do the dance? What, you're the All Blacks? Yeah, fine. And they go, I go, I love rugby.
I've got no understanding,
right? Yeah, sort of education, I think, is obviously very important, how you engage that. Engaging with youth. I don't think a lot of kids get access to rugby in schools anymore.
But do you think American football's less complicated than rugby? Yeah.
But why does American football get greater buy-in as a mass product?
Because they all play it at college. They all play it all the time.
Not necessarily true.
I'm not sure.
The product is glitzier, better, easier to follow, easier to buy into.
Is it easier to follow? I'm not sure the game is
less
technical.
But it's the storylines, the characters, the colour,
which is what our friend was saying.
Yes,
yeah, and I'd say to that, that's what comes at the end.
Yeah,
Why would you put that at the front?
Because if you haven't got the because.
But you got your 14 points because you referred to them. I mean, it's a short show, but can you just give us some of the things you've got to get right before you get to that?
I will, and before I do that, I just want to pick up on James's point. Cultural, I agree, it's cultural. I think, but I don't agree with the bit of the culture that you identified. Okay. Sport's a great example of a market failure. If you let market forces just operate in your sport, and we have largely just let market forces operate in our leagues, you'll get Scottish football eventually. You'll get two dominant teams, and that's it. And they will divide the championship in between them. And that's even in football, the biggest, the only global sport. I wish we'd stop trying to talk about rugby. Got to become a global sport, please. Rugby needs to grow in America and Japan. Okay, we'll never be a global sport until you get China and India, and we are centuries away from that. Okay, so let's stop talking about being a global sport and be realistic and say we want to grow our international footprint, because that is achievable. Okay. It is.
You could actually go back to some of the teams who've been and gone.
It's increased the gap between the haves and the have-nots, because professionalism is expensive, preparing teams is expensive. Look, we're a sport that there are only three countries in the world the sport's big enough to support a domestic league.
Right.
So just think about that for a second. Three countries in the whole world, Japan, England, and France. We've got to be realistic and look at what we are and get bigger. But if we let market forces just carry on, it won't happen.
Are you going to add to that? You were talking about the frustration. We were talking about the fact that the what's holding the game back is not necessarily the Blazers. But I wondered what you were thinking of when you said it's not that it is. Is that a good delivery?
I think it's more the complication of the decision making processes than the attitude of the people making the decisions.
Okay.
And the fragmentation of the sport and the cross interest, conflicted interest of, club versus country and all the rest of it, and getting together and aligning on that.
Did you ever get bored in the boardroom at World Rugby and doodle on the whiteboard the ideal way to run rugby full stop?
No.
Is there an ideal solution, which is somebody put it on paper, you're then trying to get everyone to buy into it, or has that never actually been done as a, if we run it like this, the whole game grows? I presume that's what CVC are trying to do, but...
There are different ways to do it. You look for how can you get growth in the fastest, most effective way. So we talked about that a lot, and it was always our belief that the international game would give you that growth far faster than the club game, which has been around for a long time as well, and the revenues are growing and so on, but does it really expand the sport? No, what expands the sport are World Cups, major international games, and the possibility of a part of the world doing better than they've ever done before in a way that surprises their population and enters their population into that sport. And that was the thinking behind the Nations League at that time, and that was the closest I think we ever got to World Rugby being at the centre. It would have been the first Nations League of any size and substantive size of any sport in the world that could have run across the globe and would have meant a lot of dollars for the sport.
And why did that not get done?
Well, because I think in the end there were entities that thought, and whether it be Six Nations and others that felt that that would incur on the Six Nations perhaps. There was promotion relegation, so unions were worried about their well-being over a period of time, understandably to a certain extent, but we were trying to give them, ways of softening that possibility over a period of time. We gave 8 year, you're allowed to survive for 8 years without that being a possibility to get the thing across the line. It still wasn't enough security for some of the unions and so on. But that would have been a global situation with enough money for all teams to have, good resources, good players, good systems underneath them and so on. And it would have brought in those markets that you need to bring in to create the growth of the sport that you need, in particular the US and Japan. At the moment, we have a closed shop at the top level of World Rugby. You can't hope to compete unless you're in the Six Nations or the Championship, and the entry into either of those is a closed club.
Sorry.
I'd agree with all of that.
Okay. Just a quick personal question for you. How much was your decision to go and do something else influenced by the failure to get that done?
Contributed to me feeling it was a good time to go and do something else. If someone had knocked me on the shoulder and said, would you like to try this? I might still be there and I'd be enjoying it and making a fist of it. But it weighed in the balance, I think. I didn't walk away from because I'd given up or whatever.
Sure.
But it was definitely for me a seminal moment that the game missed an opportunity. Now, that might come back.
I was going to say, could you ever foresee it actually getting done again?
It's possible. There's some good people at World Rugby that can help orchestrate that, maybe CBC's element and so on. But you really have to take some self-interest off the table for that to happen.
Right. And you would lay that at the door of the Six Nations?
I think they would admit it at the time that they were not keen to bind that relationship. And it was a bankroll. We had an agreement for, I can't remember the figures now, but it was something like £6 billion over 12 years and so on. It was a huge amount of money. I think in the end, the Six Nations felt more comfortable in seeking investment with CBC.
Wow.
I'm really kind of interested because I can sense almost, I know you be careful, but I can sense a frustration because it feels like you had all this in place and you were sort of almost, you want to say, castrated or neutered by these other people. If I said to you, you didn't have to put up with those stuff, you would have gone with that decision. You would have made that decision and made those changes and just gone with it.
I think it was the right decision for the sport and for the majority of nations. It may not necessarily have been in the Six Nations' interest. That's for them to judge. But
why would it not have been there? Why? Can you just conjecture as to why would it not help the Six Nations?
Because there was uncertainty.
I think there's a bit of uncertainty. There's the risk of being relegated, which is obviously the fear of all of those unions. You know, if the RFU gets relegated, which is unlikely, but if they got relegated, you never know. The ball can bounce an odd way when it's an oval shaped. But you know, that would mean and they were looking at this very seriously. You know, they really had a good look. You know, if we get relegated and we're playing Georgia at Twickenham next month instead of the teams in first division, are we going to be able to pay for the grassroots game in England? So these are real.
But this is what I mean.
These are real considerations, though.
If there's billion coming in, surely you're going to have more money overall, despite the fact you take the gamble of going down for it. You're not going to go down and stay down, are you? Can I move on to the product? Couple of comments from our YouTube viewers, and thank you for these. Stephen Pierce, it's hard to watch any game anymore. The game is so boring to watch. The laws, as we all know, need to change or the game's going to be in trouble. The laws are killing the game, he goes on to say. Bring back rucking, says another. It's a lot safer than this jackling shit. Did you leave that? No, don't know. No subs, say two at most. The game will become more open as now it's like teams with all the subs that come on defence. That doesn't actually make any sense, but essentially reduce the number of subs. The question is, Rugby World Cup and Six Nations, sensational and both growing. Champions Cup, Challenge Cup, Top 14, Premiership, Super Rugby, URC as it now is, RFU Championship, Currie Cup, NPC, I'd even go so far as to say Sevens, and if you're being really harsh, the British and Irish Lions. Which one of those is in a better place now than it was 10 years ago?
I think the URC is in a better place than it was.
Starting from a relatively low benchmark?
Yeah, but you did ask. So yeah, okay. I think that's in a better place. The top 14...
But how would you qualify that?
It's much stronger financially.
Right.
The rise of the Scottish teams has been really quite significant. They are in a miles better place than the Scottish. The Scottish regional teams were dire 10, 15 years ago. They're not. They're good times now. The rise of Connacht, who were, I can remember Connacht playing in front of 500 people at the race course, and they're a proper team now. I mean, they should have been Leicester at the weekend, and they probably given a good old Welford Road. That's you've created a really competitive new province in a relatively small country. So I'd say Omba and the introduction of the South African prompted, I think it's going to be very interesting. I think the jury's out on that, but at least it's you're giving something a go.
What would you say in response to that? I mean, predominantly it is club game, but the characters in the league. I mean, who is the biggest star in the Premiership now?
Marcus Smith.
Yeah. Okay. Who's in his second? Who's in his second year?
Well, that's what happens, isn't it?
Yeah, that's brilliant. I'm not saying, but
he's in his fourth year at Queen's.
Okay. Yes. Okay. But I would level you. There were more stars in the game 10 years ago. I think the fact that Premiership Rugby cannot give their highlights package away to a terrestrial partner shows you that the product at the moment isn't getting a lot of cut through.
Yeah. All right. Well, if we're back to the product, which you then diverted.
That was the original question.
So if we're going to talk about product, I think I'm with you. Do I think we could improve the product? Yes, I do. I don't think you actually have to change the laws to do it.
Yeah.
I'm just talking about the packaged up premiership.
And in an environment now where the landscape is getting ever more competitive, not say, only within there's sport,
any one
indi- but,
there's only one indicator of that, and that's their fan base. And I don't know, we do a weekly fan panel across the world on our fan base. It's either growing or it's not.
Right.
If it ain't growing, then the answer to your question is no. And if it is growing, the answer to your question is yes. And that's the only real indicator is the level of your fan interest and the growth in your fans at whatever segment of the population you're hoping to attract. And so I don't know if these leagues measure yearly, monthly, weekly their fan growth, how they amortize that fan growth and what the lifetime value of that for each fan is. The NFL does.
Right. Non-stop. And you know that detail down to?
No, down to a T. Wow. Down to a T. In each segment, in each category, data and analytics.
Just a quick question. What is the NF, what is the data like around young people coming into?
Because there's been huge effort in that area, 25 to 35. Huge growth area and the biggest segment certainly in Europe and growing. In the States, we're almost like the US population. I mean, in the last 20 years, 17 of the top 20 broadcast shows on television are NFL games. It's that dominant. So the fan base is very much like census. You know?
Yeah. And in Australia, sense. Four of the top five TV shows are rugby league.
Right.
Well, not just of sport. Yeah. Of all right, partly that's because of the phenomenon that State of Origin. But nevertheless, they built that since 1980. It's not been going, you know, that long, and yeah. It is a phenomenon. They get the grand final and the three Origin games get four of the top five slots in television, full stop, not in sport, in television. So you could improve the flow of the game without touching the laws, and that would, Evan talks about speeding the game up. Yeah. It's not just about how long the ball is in play. It's how long it takes from blowing the whistle at the start of the game to blowing at halftime and then the second half.
NFL doesn't have a lot of flow, I would argue.
No, that's the other extreme.
Yeah, but they monetize the lack of flow. But
that's very true.
But having said that, they measure game quality on all sorts of criteria, from number of yards passed, the quality of the referee, of the officials' decisions. There's about five or six criteria that each week they're judging every game on, in terms of a game quality, obviously how tight the game is as well, how high scoring it is, but passing yards is a big part of that.
With the NFL, obviously you're watching like past games. You know, you talk about rugby as a product. I think NFL is way more complicated. I think I don't think it is easy to understand. So, it takes an hour game, takes 4 hours to play. But so obviously the product on the field, it is not the determining factor as to whether it's the actual gameplay, like you're saying. What I'm interested in is firstly, do you think there are the business heads within the game at the moment to drive that stuff? Because I might be completely wrong, we don't know this. The metrics that you were talking about in terms of the crowd, audience, knowing all that, I've never heard anyone go into that level of detail in, for example, the Premiership. You might have known.
Yeah, which is where I would agree with the point you made earlier. Now it's in a different context. Where I would agree that there's a sort of a little bit of a value thing. We don't get a lot of our information out there. I know I'll never get this. I publish player salaries.
So I think that's a really, I definitely publish your marquee players.
But I know that's not going to happen. But what I would like to see, amongst a whole load of other things, but let's say we did something else we should do because it's cost control. Let's say we had a squad of 36, right? You can't have more than 36 players. Makes your salary cap much easier to administer and tighten and all the rest of it. But every club has to put up on their website 1 to 36 in terms of not what they're paid, but number 1's our highest paid player and number 36 is our lowest paid player. You think the amount of interest and that, why is he third on our roster? You know, he should be 10th. We're overpaying.
But that's the same thing with the stats for the NFL. Yes. Passes, yeah. Thing. Everything's a slide with a metric, with a thing, with a
everything's
money.
Measured. And I mean, my job description is to grow and monetize the fan base in Europe. Yeah. That's simple as that.
Yeah.
Now, if more players playing it helps you get more fans, it's a means to an end rather than an end in itself, then that's good. If you think it's playing games in London and Germany, if you think it's setting up an academy, if you think it's charitable foundations, if you think it's, you know, whatever you think it is, we want our 19 million fans in Germany, 16 million in the UK, 2.3 million avids in Germany, 2.8 million here. I don't know their shoe sizes, but we know a lot about those people. And we're capturing them all the time on data.
When you're in World Rugby, right, so there's great people in the room wanting to grow the game with money. I would argue that I don't think a lot of them in rugby, in the culture, both in the club, know how to put this into place and are too precious and too old school in their mentalities around marketing. For example, Hard Knocks on the NFL, embedding documentaries. Nobody wants to embed with a fucking Premiership team. As far as I can tell, from the last time I spoke...
They'll take the All Blacks and they'll take...
They'll take the All Blacks, right? But England. So England Eddie was going to do something, but I think he changed his mind at the last minute. They were going to embed with the England team, but unless it was a World Cup, it didn't have the interest, right? So if these streaming people, Netflix, Amazon, these other people, are not interested...
It's got to have some global interest.
It has some global interest. What is it we're doing that we're not showing off? I think if you look at it, there are certain boys doing certain things on social media and putting stuff out there and creating heroes that we want people to buy into. Yeah. But I'm felt up, we're hamstrung by one section. This is what I meant by the culture going, yeah, don't do that. We've never done that. This is how we do it. It's not part of what we do. It's not part of the values.
But,
think of the grassroots.
But are they? I get surprised each day with things I learn in the NFL. Yeah. Like, for example, the league office is helping orchestrate and give content to all of the players so that they can manage their
England
their social,
just started
their
doing
social
that,
media
but
accounts.
It.
But this is across the whole league, you know. Yeah. So,
but that's what I mean. But that was. But there are so many people, because I grew up through it, from literally going against the tide, getting so much shit for trying to have a personality, trying to build it. Did I get it right all the time? No. Am I a bit of a liability? Yes. But look at the NBA, right? Like Kobe Bryant, you know, RIP.
Yeah, you need that.
He was a legend of the game, one of the best to ever do it. Did he have his off-field issues? Yes. Do we sometimes put our money in false profits and make mistakes, and will they let you down because we're all human? Of course. But we don't have that in rugby. There's still a section that wants people to be quiet. They want us to be humble because they remember it from their days of playing rugby.
And I think you're right in that sense.
And I don't think there's enough people to do. So what you both are saying, we're not a million miles off in everything we're saying. No, I just don't see the mechanics.
You know, it may not be people saying it. It's just in the DNA of the dressing room. You don't know when amateur is going to leave the dressing room because it comes down
in
like
the boardroom, though. But the same thing with your decision
and
making, right?
And
the
well,
politics,
too,
right?
Yeah,
you look at the guys that you're talking about politically, right? I know, and again, we talked about this off air before the show. I don't envy your job when it was your job, because everybody thinks that you should just be able to make a decision like that. And why the fuck are you dragging your feet? And it's down to just you, and it's you not making the decision. And same thing when you were CEO, or whatever. It's not, obviously, it's not the case. But I feel in rugby, there are so many people in these boardrooms that are saying, yes, yes, I want to be progressive. But A, they don't know what that means. B, they have not grown up with it, so they don't understand it. And they have their only reference point is other rugby stuff. I know we get from people from outside, but we very much promote within. He was a great player, so we'll get him a coach. Oh, suddenly he's a director of rugby. I know it's in a lot of, look at the league, there's a lot of old boys in jobs of power. We see it a lot with the RFU. You see it with a lot of the guys. There's a lot of people who I think came through the game, which we do promote from it within, so without in some areas. But I just think there's this old school mentality. I think the NFL is the perfect example. I think it's actually fucking quite boring at times. But because of everything that's wrapped around of it, because it is a secure entity, because it is an entertainment business, everything you said about, you said about the Six Nations and that big pot of money, you came back to, well, RFU have got to protect the grassroots game. I just don't think you can't have it all. I think grassroots, I'm not saying we should get grassroots rugby, but you've got to separate it. We can't be held responsible for that.
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, you did hear.
Grassroots rugby is on its way out anyway.
No, certainly not.
Well, the numbers are astonishing in terms of the drop-off. It's gone from 270 to 95 in 6 years.
I saw that report as well. I'd like to have a little look at the data before I was completely prepared to accept that. But all the research, and it hasn't changed much for the last 25 years I've been involved, all the research suggests that if you played the game, or somebody you loved that sounds a bit sappy, doesn't
that's
it?
Rather nice.
That's
rather
nice.
Yeah,
my wife and she's not in that kingdom.
Someone who you loved, or they loved you, and they loved you, played the game, you are between 10 and 12 times more likely to watch it. Right. So this idea that it's a choice between participation, grassroots, if you want to call it that, community game, whatever, and the professional game, I think, is a complete false premise. And in fact, if you're not careful, and we come back now to cost control, I'm sorry, I keep coming back to it. If we can't control our costs, and it takes up a bigger and bigger percentage of the revenues, whatever they are that we generate, to keep the lights on in professional rugby, the game at community level will wither. Rugby Union Australia is going through a really tough patch. And 20 years ago, they had a bit of a golden era. They won a World Cup in 99, if you remember. And there was a lot of talk in Australia how rugby union was going to go past rugby league and become the second sport in the country before AFL. And the strategy that they employed largely, I'm simplifying to a degree for brevity, was that they bet the house on the Wallabies and the professional game. And the level of participation in rugby union in Australia fell off a cliff, and it's been a disaster. Their TV audience now, partly because their results haven't been great lately, but they've still got a World Cup final in 2015. You know, it hasn't been a complete disaster for a relatively small country. All the evidence that I've seen suggests that because they've lost their participation base, they've lost their audience, and you lose their audience, you lose money. And if you lose money, you're going to struggle to compete and grow your sport. So I think this idea that somehow it's a choice between participation and professionalism is a completely false choice.
And when I first came into World Rugby, everyone was obsessed by player numbers and participation. But that doesn't add up to the game. And is anyone measuring the fan base? We didn't. So we started doing research, annual research on fan base and where it was growing and what segments were growing around the world, take the top 10 markets, and away we went. And we included, markets like the US and Japan, who before you wouldn't have thought about as much since the World Cup in Japan you do and so on. And it was fascinating, but it was all about the fans and how social media performing in those markets and what are the unions doing in social media in those markets. And I'm not saying you swing the needle all the way, it's all just about fans because rugby's coming from a very participation mindset. But definitely that needle needed to be moved on to, because you will not grow a sport unless you grow your fans. You can look at everything else, they're spending too much money, the broadcasting, everything's related to the size of your fan base and how much those fans are willing to spend on your sport, whether it be through, subscriber television, OTT, merchandise, betting, etc. It's all about how much your fans are invested in your sport.
I mean, as a player, a young player, I never wanted to be a rugby player. But what I remember is obviously I played it, but just because I did it to school. I went to rugby based schools. What got me excited and wanted to emulate was Jonah Lomu, your Brian O'Driscolls, was your Richie McCaws, your Lawrence Delalios, your Joe Worsies, those characters. And because I followed the game and actually went to the clubs and watched them, I got part of their personalities. For things like the other sports I'm interested in, I have never played most of them. It's all to do with what I visually saw, why they were attractive. UFC, Cristiano Ronaldo, Messi, all these guys, because of everything that goes with it, because I think the spectacle and the business around that spectacle is what sells it. And I just don't think in rugby, because we are obsessed, I think, with trying to be all things to all men and we don't package it up, that's where we're going to lose it. But you said statistically that might be wrong with the participation, but I just don't think it's that relevant.
I think we might be conflating some different things here. Okay. I can't find a league anywhere in the world that hasn't based its initial domestic growth on a significant participation base. I refuse to accept that you can't touch urban areas because look at, and I'll use both codes, look at Hull. Rugby League's a big sport in urban. That's a tough urban environment. Rugby League's big in Leeds. Rugby Union's big in Bristol. It's not dominant in Bristol, but it's big in Bristol. You can if you work at it, but the market won't do it on its own. You have to plan it. You can make inroads into those kind of areas. I totally accept the point you're making. And Brett's making about social media importance and how you package it up and what it looks like and the rest
of it. You've also got the quality. So I think the problem in Australia was it's always been an incredibly small player base.
Yeah.
So the second that falls off in the slightest, you suddenly haven't got the material to run a competition like the Super League and so on. You've got too many clubs, not enough quality players. You haven't got the feed into the Wallabies, which is, sorry, so you're importing players. So it was more, I think, a reservoir of talent issue than therefore I love it issue.
Again, we come back to the club game maybe. We can talk all you like about various other factors. If I could have one for the last 25 years, our elite club game has hardly ever been on free-to-air.
Well, let's come on to the television.
Right. And why is that? We come back to the same thing. Because free-to-air doesn't pay short-term revenue.
And that was the same issue
and therefore you get just exactly the same in Australia. And you then come back to this situation where you go, persuade clubs who are already losing a pile of money to lose even more because in the long run, it'll work. I tell you, that's a tough sell.
But you've had your hybrid deal with BT Sport and Channel 5 showing 5 Premiership games a season.
Yeah, exactly. And you've just said it. 5 Premiership games a season. Look, if you're going to build a narrative in a competitive broadcast land, you cannot do it on 5 games a season.
Okay. I want to come on to the TV rights in just a moment. I just sort of want to summarise. I think going back to the original question, which product is better now than it was a decade ago? I don't think Champions Cup, Challenge Cup, Top 14 is flying, but no one watches this outside. They cannot give the rights away outside of France at the moment. We'll argue about Premiership. Super Rugby is fragmented. I think URC is very embryonic. I'm not sure that Stormers against Connacht in 4 years' time is going to have anyone getting out of bed at the right time of the day to watch it necessarily.
But Leinster against the Sharks might.
Do you think?
Maybe.
The question really about the TV landscape, as a fan in England, in this country now, You need BT to watch Premiership in Europe. You can catch a bit of Europe on Channel 4. Channel 5 did do five Premiership games and turned down the free-to-air rights. URC, I think, is on Premier, S4C and Virgin Media in Ireland. Six Nations is on the BBC and ITV. Rugby World Cup is on ITV. Rugby Championship and the Lions are on Sky. A bit of the Lions was also on Channel 4. Super Rugby was on a website. Top 14 don't have a home. And the Autumn Nations Championship was on Amazon.
Top 14's on Premier, but I'm being picky.
I beg your pardon. Top 14 is on Premier. Rewrite. If you're a rugby fan now, you're going to spend most of the afternoon trying to find the rugby, let alone knowing where to go. Talk to me about the importance of finding a home for rugby where rugby fans can go and access. Which, as you know, I'll put a personal vested interest in here. I can remember being at Sky when we had it all, and everyone was like, it's so unfair that Sky have got a monopoly. But I can tell you which one of those two I prefer.
It. You could find it, yeah.
Is that a ridiculous scenario, or is that good for the game?
It's a reflection of the fragmentation of the sport in terms of each entity being driven by different people with different commercial objectives in different stages of development, surviving or trying to thrive with what they've got and with different demands. I want revenue. I don't want visibility. You see the ones that are more governing body oriented, World Cup, Six Nations, they want to grow the sport. They want the widest group of people seeing them. That's a good strategy. But if you're running a club that's limping, financially, just give me the money now and we'll look after the future as we go. I understand that. I mean, you know, one of the benefits of some of the investors coming into the sport at one point was aggregation, and World Rugby could have that role too. But it's more digital aggregation, probably of a streaming product that over time will become the main product. But that needs to start to being set up. You know, there needs to be one hub for rugby and divide it up in terms of revenues and results. They've got to put those foundations into place for the future, because it's not always going to be about free-to-air or even pay channel. It's going to be about direct-to-consumer. And that might happen in 5 years. It might happen in 10. But it's the future. And that aggregation is going to be possible. And CBC talked about this when they're investing in the game as well, as were some of the other suitors at the time and so on. So that aggregation, I think, is an inevitability of the sport and all sport.
The thing that fell out of last week's show, and David Buttress made this point over and over and over again, is we have to speed everything up. And one of the questions I was going to ask you is about how frustrated you were at World Rugby, that decision-making went on and on, at speed and transparency. You know, the decision-making around the Tier 2 ability to pay for a second
nation. The speed of decision is a function of how many people are involved in that decision. There are 30-odd people and countries in a room to make fundamental decisions at World Rugby. That's a lot of people taken into consideration.
And you said about the self-interest element as well, same as that.
It's difficult, whereas if you've got a streamlined board that's business-oriented.
Is that what rugby needs?
Well, I think it's evolving towards that, certainly at the World Rugby level, but it's still very much at the end of the day, a lot of things will be voted through account. A lot of the power moved to the executive committee over the time I was there, which is a good streamlined business conscious move of the sport, and that's still evolving in that direction. But to get very big major change, you've got to have all countries in the group on the council voting for that to happen, and that means it's quite a slow process.
Doesn't it alarm you, though? Doesn't, like, when you read that out, I know we're all sitting in the room and we've made it very clear that nothing we said this was going to change anything, but when you read out all the dynamics about the kind of the viewing and how we need to centralise it, and we can't even agree, it's almost quite disheartening. When you look at, I know where rugby is and it'll carry on and we sort of, you know, but it is very disheartening when you are just the completely fractured nature of all of it, and how you're actually going to make this stuff. How do you get a broadcaster? How do you link it up? How do you create a hub? How do you get us all to agree? Because they just don't. It's so hard.
And there's no forum for everyone to sit in the same room, by the way. Occasionally, World Rugby will organise a forum, but the club leagues, whether they be in France or England or elsewhere, aren't embedded in the governance of World Rugby. They're represented by unions. And through that, the leagues are represented from their countries.
I just come back to this speed and transparency point. I made a few notes literally off the bat. Argentina came third in 2007 Rugby World Cup. Stunning story. It took 5 years to get them into a major tournament. Japan created arguably the most jaw-dropping moment in the tournament's history with their win over South Africa. They're still not in a meaningful competition 7 years on. You know, Georgia desperately cling on to hopes of top-flight rugby. Canada have not made the Rugby World Cup 2023 for the very first time. Romania, Ivory Coast, Zimbabwe, Spain, Portugal, Russia, all been to World Cups, but
that's because those competitions where they should be entering to grow the sport
won't let them in
because it's going to cost them rather than give them money. Now, if someone knocks at the door with a big check, they'll let them into either.
But you had that big check, and they still didn't say yes to the rugby.
Yeah, I was thinking more of a nation coming in, nation saying coming. We come in, the broadcast rights will go up hugely. Or
which is
well, there's a whole lot more. So you're talking about the slow nature of change around the concussion protocols. Yeah. I do not understand how South Africa were the recommended hosts for Rugby World Cup 2023, and France end up with a tournament. That surely, as for the good of the game, has to have an element of transparency around it. It's things like even the Pacific Islands. So there's an astonishing stat. First four Rugby World Cups, 87 to 99, Samoa and Fiji made the knockouts four times between them. And until 1999, players could change nations. So from 2000 onwards, they couldn't. We've had one quarter finalist in the ensuing five World Cups, which was Fiji in 2007. The Pacific nations asked in 2010 to have that decision reversed, and it's taken 12 years for it to go through. That is like, I mean, obviously the time is in the detail.
Divided boardroom on that. Some really were against it, some were for it. And it's taken a while for one half to migrate a bit towards the other's direction, and that's how long it takes in these.
But that's astonishing,
it
is, isn't it?
But who are these guys?
It's taken 12 years to fix a problem that is, I mean, the damage that has been done to Pacific Island rugby in that time. The final example I was going to throw out there, and it's nothing to do with you, I'm just putting it out there in case.
Well,
it took 5 months for World Rugby to issue a punishment to Razzy Erasmus for his rant in the summer. Formula One at the end of this season were chaotic. They were making real-time decisions that influenced the entire outcome, and they had the whole review done in 24 hours. That surely has to be the way now that sport is run. That's what fans want. They want the moment. They don't want a five-month delay.
Yeah. It's rare, though, in World Rugby, they usually go pretty quickly and get criticised for jumping on someone. That's an example that's unusual, I think. Usually, I think in disciplinary areas, they move quite quickly in World Rugby. They move pretty decisively. That's my experience.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Well, we used to get our knuckles wrapped for it, and you know why you'd get the from whatever union was being punished, you would get huge flack for a period of time, and there'd be all sorts of political manoeuvrings to to make you feel uncomfortable and whatever. But that you know, I don't. Maybe those decisions aren't almost independent enough from the politics. That's probably the issue at World Rugby. They're embedded in the World Rugby system, but they're probably too close to where the votes are and where the politicians are. And it probably should be, it should not expose the politicians to those issues. I mean, I think you get a faster moving judiciary.
What is the outcome if you do make these decisions? What, it's just the political fallout, or it's going to pull yourself apart? Because the concussion one's a really interesting one. So I was obviously obviously talked about deduction of contact within
training
and everything else. Yeah. And obviously World Rugby have come out and said, I think it's like 2023 or something like that day. I might be wrong, but basically they've given themselves a few years to change that, which I think you could change overnight. I don't just tell the club.
But
are they
looking to research in that period?
I think there's some nuanced bits about it, but I think medically the neurologist have turned around and said it would make a massive difference. The NFL do it now, and they've proven to do it, and the NFL are already our blank canvas to follow, but we refuse to follow them. But what rugby league have done is the 21 days concussion for the, they basically said that this return to play for 7 days, which was normally what happened, which was changed from 21 days for your first concussion. Rugby League have turned around and said, no, the first concussion will be 21 days. They've done it overnight. World Rugby sit and talk about all these things they want to do, and they don't do it. It is genuinely as simple, and this specific thing is going, clubs have got to reduce contact. Obviously, by next season, you've got to do it. The rule's gone back to 21 days. No nonsense. Don't need to look at it. Don't need details. NFL have already proven that. Yeah. But I don't understand why we can't do it. I'm not blaming you.
The governance structure is really interesting, different. I'll give you another example. It staggered me when I worked at the NRL how quickly they could make decisions. And I didn't quite
understand.
But
how exciting is that to be part of a league where things happen?
It was terribly exciting. It's a very exciting league. It's got lots of issues, but it's a very exciting league.
But you don't have to consult with 115 unions, every change of any element of rugby, because it is a global sport.
So Peter Valandis, who's the chairman of the NRL these days, last season or the season before, he literally didn't. Can you imagine this happening in rugby unions? It's pure down to governance. This is the difference. Effectively, nobody else. Well, they pretty much ignore Super League in the UK, which is the only other rugby league competition. And so he's chairman, and they watched the first six games, and he didn't like what was happening in the ruck, in the tackle. So he got on a press conference on Monday morning and said, "We're changing the rules." He got up on a Monday and said, "I'm changing it. This is the new rule." Why? Well, because there's no one else involved in that decision. It is a purely NRL decision. You can't possibly You'll never get that in a rugby is a global sport in one sense. It has lots and lots of countries.
But also they're very thorough in their testing. Yes. They don't do player welfare. No. So they don't make rash, knee-jerk decisions. And I think that's pretty good. But in terms of the contact at training, surely that's something that the leagues themselves can...
The thing is, it's what it should be, but they can't be trusted.
I think, yeah, okay, well, that's a different
problem.
Issue.
That's the problem. Like, for example,
they could easily make World Rugby getting involved. In fact, they're delegating to World Rugby.
I agree with you. But they see it as the big. They see it as the big brother. You know, World Rugby, if they say it...
They'll be very influenced by the governance of those leagues, the French Union and the RFU.
Yeah.
If those two unions wanted to drive through a 24-hour change, it would happen.
I agree.
So, you know, who knows what the backstory is.
Just one thing, sorry, just about the club thing is very interesting, because I think there is actually the facility to make those decisions. Not about World Rugby, it's only because we were sort of talking about the other decisions around some of the, you know, which country you play for and stuff, and that's why I came onto it, because World Rugby have been verbal about the concussion thing in particular. But I'll give you an example. So I was doing stuff with the RPA and they wanted to do that season extension, right? And they basically came to us and all the players, we all sat down in all of our different teams and said, we don't want it. We're not interested. So they went, go away, we negotiate it. And then they announced a season extension. And we all said we didn't want to do it. They just did it anyway and told us to fuck off, right? Essentially, and just ignored it and it basically carried on. My concern is that I think it does come down to that central governance, because when we had all the COVID issue with the reduction in salaries, where it ultimately turned out to be the right thing, my concern was not giving up some of my salary, but actually the way it was handled, the way it was communicated, the way the clubs acted. And because they are essentially autonomous, because their owners own them, PRL, we basically came to the conclusion, we really liked them, but they were a bit ineffective when it suited them. We couldn't, I think that just nobody makes the right decisions because everyone's self-interested. I think there's a lot of old mentality when I'm very concerned that we're just not going to be able to find a central ground, but we can actually make some decisions. And I think it's going to take somebody somewhere just to do it. Like Mark said, what is the worst that's going to happen?
The reason that happens is because you haven't got a collective bargaining agreement.
Right.
So in all the other countries and not in other sports, but just never mind other sports, just rugby's response to COVID, right? Wages went down in New Zealand. They went down in Australia. They went down in what? But it was done centrally. The Players Association was very strong in those countries, negotiated with the league. And that's the way it should be. That's the way grown-up sports are governed, right? I half blame the RPA here as well. So they have a responsibility as well. Whenever a collective bargaining agreement has been floated, shall we say, let's just say no hands were bitten off. Now, so you can't have it both ways.
I understand.
Right? If you genuinely want a collective group representing the players to have power, you have to negotiate a CBA. There's no other, then they're really complicated, right? And they're very long. And the one in the NBA is 500 pages long, but they last for 10 years.
Mm.
And if you want to get away from that, and I agree with you, I think it's a ridiculous way. And it was really poor. It was a bad look for the game. And it put the players in a difficult position, but the structures aren't there to do it another way.
Right.
The hardest thing about my job, as it was at World Rugby, and I'm sure Alan Gilpin's having the same issues, is every time someone puts a microphone and says, what does World Rugby think of? And why isn't it World Rugby? And why isn't it World Rugby? Because World Rugby's not the CEO or one or two people making calls. So every time that question gets asked, you're going, like, on the question of the homecoming rule, which is allowing the Pacific Island players to go back and play for their country of origin, so on. There were questions asked over the period. All I knew was that three quarters of the room didn't want it, whether I wanted it or not. What's your view, Brett? Well, no, World Rugby's view is at the moment there's no appetite for it, or there's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Because you've got to try and articulate the most succinct,
political,
common,
succinct,
well,
yeah,
political, but it's got to, yeah, you can't give a view that's not the view of the 30-year-old voting, you know, nations that are changing the face. That was the most complicated thing, because you wanted to give a sense of one direction, purpose, and articulate a clear position. You couldn't always do that. That's the hardest thing about
the
job.
And a much smaller level, I've heard off the record, but I will say it anyway.
no one listens to this.
So Mark McCafferty, for example, I know, who I thought was long-standing and made a very good track record in many, many areas. And I know, because he's a friend, you know, he would say on a similar level, you know, everyone says, oh, you're CEO of Premiership Rugby, PRL.
You're actually just facilitating the 12 or 13 clubs.
But actually, if you can't get your clubs on board, you've just got to bite your tongue.
You're facilitating, but you are trying to get...
To manoeuvre.
You're trying to get to the right answers each time, but you can't guarantee them.
But you're not sitting in that room, just about in that, for example, that players thing. I mean, what was it be an argument against that? Because you ask us as players, right, you ultimately should really care. You know, like you talk to... Because, again, this is the separation I talk about, the culture.
In terms
you
of the homecoming rule?
Yeah, homecoming rule, right?
I think there were some people that were worried about that it would blur the sovereignty. You know, you'll confuse the nation with everyone going back to that place, playing for that country, playing for this country. When you get that swapping of countries, it can be a little bit messy and it can be a little bit diluting on the integrity of the product. There's a little bit of that. Are some nations bringing in players and buying a conscience because they can send them back at the end of their time? So is there going to be, are all of the players going to go to one or two Southern Hemisphere countries or to the North or to the, and people will feel that's fine too? I mean, there were lots of things that were being argued at the time as a counter.
Were you pro or anti personally? Not as World Rugby. Please don't say you could see the benefit of both sides.
No.
He's just trying to think of anything on record.
It's genuinely interesting because you had all the facts.
It didn't come up very often.
That's not the answer to the question.
Yeah, I know. I didn't have strong feelings either way on that topic.
Okay. I did.
I honestly didn't have strong. And I probably, if I'm really to confess, was probably worried that it might look a bit messy, players changing.
Because
I'm thinking World Cup. And you got one World Cup where one guy turns up in one jumper and lots of them then will turn up in another jumper and hang on, didn't he play for...
But what a story.
England? Yeah, which is, you know, but ultimately now in time, I think it's probably the right thing that they've done because I think, because what's happened in the meantime is there's a little bit of, you know, money difference between the haves and the have-nots. So anything that can continue to make Rugby World Cup more competitive is a good thing. So in that sense, now I'd say it's a good thing.
Everybody is fighting for their piece of what is ultimately not a huge cake. Can you ever envisage a scenario in which one of the power brokers says, I'm prepared to cede my power at this point for the good of the game?
I think they all think they're doing that, though.
Genuinely?
I don't know, but I think they're there to represent their union.
Of course they are.
And that's, to them, the good of the game. I'm doing what, you know, Scotland want me to do, Ireland want me to do.
Surely stronger together.
But I think the Nations Championship was the opportunity for the unions to sit there and say, this is what's going to be great for the game, if we want to develop on a worldwide basis. This is going to allow people in the top table on merit. And this means that every game that's played in the international sphere counts and means something towards a competition, isn't just a fixture. And I think that opportunity was missed at that point in time.
Sounds to me like you think it'll come back.
Oh, I hope it does. I don't know if it will or won't, but there were nations sitting around that table that thought this could lead to my demise. Because, you know, if you've suddenly got Japan, US knocking at the door of the top table, then how long am I going to last at the top table? I'm sure there was a bit of that too.
Who do you think is progressive? Like, if you were to look at those nations and those people, because again, I, without looking at the dynamics, because I haven't looked at that, like, you know, World Rugby and the different councils are. I see this is where it's difficult to cast judgment on,
but
in terms of the feeling of you, so bear in mind what we've talked about today and what your experiences of the NFL now, and Mark, with you going abroad, you know, is there progressive minds in rugby to take it forward on that world stage and on that club stage, or is there not? And you don't have to name people, but from what
but there are a lot of non-progressive minds as well. I mean, there's the...
No, I know, but I would...
On the fence answer, but it's...
I would say that my feeling, that if you looked at it as a whole, we are far less progressive, because even some of the, just the nuances around that, the homecoming thing, around this other stuff, for a player, right, and normally, for example, Billy Vunipola, Maka Vunipola, right, for playing for England, diehard fans, these people who've got born up with rugby, who get really get really excited about going to Principality, or they live and breathe it, right? Rugby players, we are professionals. All we've known is rugby. We want to win. We don't have that burning hatred, or most of us don't, for the opposition. We just don't want to win. We're the best version. We want to earn good cash. We want to have a great time doing it, be part of a team. So when we play with, I've got friends who go, but Billy and Mac, oh, can't believe they're playing for England. I was like, well, they were fucking born in England. I've got Dylan Hartley, you know, as a Kiwi, a mate of mine. Oh, he's a bit of a plastic Englishman. He's one of the most proud Englishmen I've ever met. As players, I would love to see Charles Piatow, because he's one of the best players in the world, should be playing for Tonga. I don't care. We in the game want everything that we want, but it seems that none of us, well, all the ones currently do it, none of our ambition is matched by anyone else, or for the majority isn't matched. Because we doing it want it to be completely different than it is, yet it's run by people who keep telling us it should be another way.
I think that's true on certain, if I may, on certain issues. I think there's certainly other issues that I would be interested in engaging with, and I wouldn't expect my views to be particularly popular in the short run amongst the players. Well, I think we've touched on some of that. I think player salaries in England are unsustainable. So therefore, I think that they should be. If I came in and said, right, give me carte blanche, and you could actually deliver it. I wouldn't expect that to be particularly popular. Although I would argue it's for the good long-term growth and good of the sport. I think the tension is always, and it's true at World Rugby, are you representing your country or are you representing the sport? And at league level, am I representing my club or am I representing the growth of the league?
Can't you
and
do
until,
both?
Well, I'd always say, genuinely, I always used to say league, always. The league must come first, because it's a terrible cliche, a rising tide floats all boats. In the end, you can't grow, you really can't. You haven't got enough influence as a single club to grow in the way that I think some of the clubs could grow.
The executive board of World Rugby, they say park your national caps at the door before you come into this room for an executive committee meeting, which was mostly true, I think, in the early years that I was there, probably.
Not so much at the end,
I don't think.
And why was that? Why did it go away from what you were trying? It sounds like it's going backwards.
Just in terms of, maybe the stakes got higher in the debates, and maybe there was, the future was changing a bit quick for some, and it probably changed over a large period of time. Sometimes it was a great committee that would, great board that would have that sense of rugby. And other times they were made up of people who had more of their local interests at heart. So that's always the tension in that room in an executive committee meeting at World Rugby.
We must wrap. I'd love to. I mean, I sort of was hoping for a bit of clarity, but I feel that the fog has come down even further. And you must have felt that on a daily basis, really. It doesn't seem that anyone's prepared to give up power. It doesn't seem that any decisions are being made quickly. It doesn't seem that anybody's getting around the table and finding a unified vision about how to grow the game. Everybody, as we've just said, the market is fragmenting. Everybody's trying to fight for their own little piece of cake harder than they've ever done before.
Of
course it can get there, but the way the game is run currently, it will never be able to thrive as it could, yes or no?
It's not reaching its potential. Yeah, I'd agree with that. Because of the fragmentation of the sport. Yeah.
It needs structural and governance reform at national and international level. I think national's easier. I think it's easy, but I think it's... And I am eternally optimistic. I've been banging many of these...
We've had 26 years of optimism.
And I come back to my catapult. And this is not an excuse or a reason to let people off the hook, because I think it's fairly that I don't do that. But I don't think you can underestimate the missed century and how complicated, therefore, we are trying.
But we had 100 years of watching other people do it and get it wrong.
It feels like we are
deeper in them than anybody.
Yeah, the worrying thing is, as I said to you before, it's all about capturing the fans. That will be the missed opportunity if rugby doesn't organise itself properly, because they'll never get these opportunities back. And they'll lose the race, because every other sport, every other league, every other brand is out there fighting for the hearts and minds of fans, and you've got to give your sport the best chance of doing that. And obviously a certain coherence in your sport and a less fractured, less fragmented voice is going to help you win fans, and that's the ultimate objective.
Clearer narrative, easier to understand.
Can I ask you a mischievous question to finish? Where there is chaos, there is opportunity, someone once said.
Yes.
Player wages going down, too many games, fractured markets all over the place. Just a general discontent across the board.
Well, I think that's the opportunity the investors have seen in the sport. It's not reaching its potential. That's what an investor does.
Absolutely.
If I come in, I'm going to help it reach their potential. And whether they can or not, we'll see.
That's
the observation.
You look at Twiggy Forest and the league that you were a part of. You look at what World 12s are trying to do. World 10s popped up in Bermuda and possibly would have had another crack were it not for COVID. Do you think a Packer style, hello, everybody come and play with me and we'll do it properly and we'll build you into stars and we'll make the league that you want to play in and it'll be razzmatazz. Do you think there is a...
It's called the World Cup, isn't it?
I don't know, is it? It's every four years, and it's a once in a generation thing. I'm saying it's unlikely.
It could have been a World Nations Championship annually, which is what we were talking about.
Do you think
that was what we were talking about at the time. Maybe 3 years in four, a World Cup. Maybe 2 years in four, but a regular, probably three seasons, annual World Championship with a World Cup festival in one place every 4 years.
Yeah.
And that was the proposition on the table. So that was organising the increased value in each game, increased money in the sport, and a coherence for the viewers at an international level. And the opportunity for new big economies to come into the game to create higher broadcast values and higher commerciality. We're dealing in a closed shop.
And in order to get
very
that,
hard to expand from a closed
you've
shop.
Got to create enough space for the national leagues and cross-border leagues to breathe. You can't just squeeze them out. And I keep coming back to this, everyone's going to have to give a few weekends up, because we can't keep just adding more and more and more games. And that's not because I'm some kind of sort of advocate for, you know, well, obviously everyone's an advocate.
And I think everyone agrees with that. It's just, can you give up your games rather than that?
Well, you're after you. But it's going to have to be everybody. I mean, you can actually, good, you say, ever get out of the paper. I do it all the time. Yeah, you can actually, with each of the three levels giving up one or two weekends, you can get really close. You really can, to virtually no overlap and clear narratives. It's not that far away.
But we talked about, you know, during COVID, I think COVID was the time to reorganize this. Because as a player, as a former player, 2 years or 3 years out of the game, whatever it is, I would have had Premiership. And you know, even when I was playing in the Highlanders, we obviously played one away and home and alternated. So we didn't play everyone twice. We didn't play the Australian teams twice. No one complained about that. Didn't play the South African teams twice. We played them once at home and then the following year played them away. I would have done the Premiership, maybe done that, and made those games even more of a bigger spectacle. So they were actually much more of a derby, you know. And then I would have got rid of every other of these nonsense championships, put the sponsorship into it, all the, you know, the power, whatever the hell it is now, the AMP, whatever.
Right, get rid of all those.
All that
get
nonsense,
rid of the
AMP, right.
Get rid of the Premiership Cup.
Get rid of all of that.
Get rid of all of that.
Invest in the championship?
No.
That's another show.
No, we're not doing that now.
But it's about playing time.
All I would say about that is...
It's just all over the place.
It really is all over the place. What I would say about that is... Every successful domestic league, and we haven't got one, you have to have a well thought through, viable second tier, whatever it might be.
Okay. Would you ever come back to rugby?
I'm very happy where I'm, very busy where I'm. Yeah, look, I would, because I love rugby. Of course I'd come back to rugby in whatever way that would be. But I'm, you know, it's unlikely to happen because I'm enjoying what I'm doing and I'll see that through. But I watch rugby as much as I did when I was CEO of World Rugby. I enjoy it a lot more because I'm not worried about the referee decisions as much as I was, the shape of the game, how many scrums are collapsing, etc.
I'd also say that on the start of the show, we asked you what percentage you were going to give away. You've given away about 30% today. So if you want to come back...
That's not what they'll tell me.
No one's going to get you. You'll be fine. You're welcome. Literally, they will welcome you back to the red carpet.
Do you think I was a bit reserved?
I think you were.
I think you were. A bit cautious? What do you reckon?
I think you're in an impossible position. Is my honest answer. I think, I mean, we're trying to find clarity here. I love the game, but I just sort of find it very hard to love the game.
It's easy for me to trash it,
Alex.
It's easy for me to trash it as well because I'm in it and I don't have any responsible people.
Yeah, no, but look, I probably have the habit of caution in the role that I've had for the last 9 years and even in the role I've got now. So I'm, you know, it's difficult to... either throw people under the bus or because at each different time, different individuals, different countries are responsible for things not happening.
Yeah.
You can't generalise in these instances, other than the system is a complex one.
You've got to run to a call.
I do.
NFL calling.
It is.
You've got to go. Thank you so much for your time and giving as much as you could. It's been absolutely fascinating. I don't envy you in the job you've had, and I don't quite know where the game goes from here. I want to ask you one more question.
Mm.
Where is rugby going to be in 5 years' time? I bet you we're still here having the same conversations.
No, I don't think we will be. I really don't. What I don't think you can look for, because I think it's unrealistic, is some kind of magic bullet that fixes everything. Fixing the things that can be fixed that are not easy, and they're not, but they are doable in the relatively short run. Brett hinted at it, more than hinted at it, actually. I think the whole rationalisation of international rugby, call it the Nations Cup, call it what you like, that will come back at relatively soon. I think there's just too many things in its favour for it to be stuck in a cupboard for 20 years. I just don't think that's going to happen. It just happens to be not my particular area of real interest. I'm one of these very rare people. I find club and league rugby I love the top 14. I love the Premiership. I love Super Rugby.
I love it more than international rugby. So that's where my real interest lies. So, you know, I think you can make serious fixes there. I do think we'll see Japan integrated pretty soon, which they never have been before, into that system. I think there's not be too dismissed. The arrival
they had
of Fiji,
a crack at Super Rugby, didn't they? Sunwolves.
Yes, but the Sunwolves. But now, I mean, in the championship or the equivalent of the championship, okay, instead of South Africa, maybe. Who knows?
Mm. South Africa into the Six Nations?
I don't know. I mean, it's an MCAN 7, and that's another scheduling issue. But then you go things like, and let's not forget the progress that will happen soon with Fiji and
Pacifica Moana.
Thank you very much. I was struggling to remember.
Alex knows all the details.
It's great.
And so, look, it's not, you know, I hate it when people say, oh, woe is me. And there are some things whereby, you know, World Cup in the States in 31 looks very likely. That is a huge prize for the game and gives us a massive opportunity. If I was a pessimist, I'd have given this up a long, long time ago. I'm not. I do think you can make significant change for the better, albeit as anyone knows me will tell you, I get terribly, terribly frustrated, but you don't give up, do you?
Yeah, I mean,
I think
Mark's right, because I think, you know, we often always on this podcast want to be very positive. And I think when we talk about these things, because we're talking the minutiae of certain things and certain really kind of polarizing aspects, we become quite downhearted and frustrated. At the end of the day, the game at the moment is not going anywhere. The sun will rise tomorrow. We will have premiership games. We'll have great internationals. The Six Nations about to start. We will have some magical moments. I think where my real frustration lies is there is some very simple, easy wins that could be done. There are some decisions that could be made. Now, not everyone might like them, but life has proven you cannot please everybody. You need to do what is best for the good of the game and what common sense dictates, what business and statistics show is the right thing to do. And I think, you know, from my perspective, Ellis touched on it nicely. You've talked about it before. You know, we have to raise interest in the narrative around the players, around the game, around what we box up. You know, kind of the way the stats-driven stuff, I think, with the NFL would work really well. I think we need to, you know, even unifying where we can access it. I know, for example, I saw about the internationals with the Amazon taking you know, the broadcasting rights to say the Autumn Nations Cup, right? Everyone got really arsey. All these old boys and the people that sort of saying, well, you know, we wanted to watch free to air. Most people buy stuff off Amazon. If you buy stuff off Amazon, more often than not, you have an option to have the streaming app, and it was free. But people just don't know that because they're so out of touch, they don't realise that they could actually have watched it at home if they wanted to have watched it. Majority, or they could have watched it on a computer. I know it's not an ideal watching experience, but a lot of people digest their content through their phones. So there are things that can happen, but we just need to be more progressive. And I think we need to put the right people in the right place and look at some of these, because I'm interested what he was saying about half the board and some of the people. I don't understand how you can be opposed to what we're talking about, and who is it, and how are we electing these people? And I think, you know, I've talked about World Rugby before, and they're not the panacea that fixes everything, but we maybe need to take more interest in who the hell we're voting in, players, who's in charge of these things, look at what's going on, because otherwise we complain about it, but there's nothing worse than kicking stones and doing fucking nothing about it as a player.
That'd be a very interesting exercise. Vote in. Players get to vote in the executives.
I'd be interested to see because I don't understand.
Ask the CEO of World Rugby.
Well,
would
you
shake
see,
it up
you
a
can do things like, and other unions have, but you have a formal relationship between the Players Association and the governing body stroke the league. One of the things you negotiate for is a seat on the board.
Yeah.
Which seems to me to be entirely reasonable.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway, I'm still, you know, you keep battling.
You're still
you?
Positive.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed that you're still positive. Mark, thank you so much for coming
Pleasure.
In. We'd love to do this again another time. I'm going to need a couple of months therapy before we do it. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Brett. Lovely to get your views as well. Just before we go, a few bits in our usual GBNR Spiz section. Don't forget to get your GBNR tour tickets if you haven't already. We're heading across the UK and Ireland to a variety of venues, probably one near you, wherever you're listening or watching. Come and join us. Tins and I would love to see you, and Hask will. Hopefully, love to see you.
Yeah, I would love to see you just at a distance behind a velvet rope.
Lovely. Sheffield, Liverpool, Edinburgh, Cardiff, Newcastle, Manchester, Dublin, Nottingham, Plymouth, Swansea, London, Birmingham, Bath, Oxford and Southend. See you there if you're coming along. We've got some great guests, actually. One or two really big guests who we can't announce yet, but we've got Chris Ashton joining us, Nick Easter, Jiffy Davis. If you were with us in Cardiff that night, you will know only too well how hot a ticket that's going to be. Ben Kayser, Hamish Watson up in Edinburgh, and Jack Knoll down in Plymouth. So loads of goodies and lots more coming as well. We've got a good one coming for our London show. Make sure, if you haven't already, to catch last week's The Good, the Scouts and the Rugby with the 7-star Jazz Joyce. Big week for Welsh women's rugby. The first female players have been awarded professional contracts by the WRU, and unsurprisingly, Jazz was front of the queue to get one. So great news for her, great news for the girls over the bridge. You can hear all about her Olympic journey, her time on the 7 circuit, and finally finishing off her teacher training as well, which Mike saw as an opportunity to learn some parenting tips. We could all do a few of those. I'm not quite sure where this show leaves us on the state of the game right now. More questions than answers?
Yes. I mean, there are some glaring holes, let's put it that way, but I think we talked about trying to remain positive. And I genuinely think someone with a bit of foresight and some determination and the eagerness to break a few eggs to make an omelette, and it may cause offence, may ruffle a few feathers, but I think that's what it needs to...
You got anyone in mind? Cause offence, break eggs, ruffle feathers.
Shmames Schmaskel
for President of World Rugby.
You've had your chance, time to move on.
Keep believing, even if it's quite tough at times. I think next week we should fuel up on gin again. I need a strong drink.
Laughter. I can have a bit of entertainment. I don't know what we're doing next week, but we can have a go at it.
We'll work it out as we go. We've been The Good, the Bad and the Rugby. We will see you next week. The show is pulled together by producers Shara Kilgallen and the world-class fixer Matt Chuck Norris. The Good, the Bad and the Rugby is a Folding Pocket production. Have a good week.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good, the Bad and the Rugby. It can't have been easy.